countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Now with our highest ever readership of 321,000 weekly readers. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing you expert commentary and analysis on what your future farm payments will look like.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, Irish Rural Link celebrates 30 years. Seamus Bolan, CEO, joins us. We talk to the EU Commission about Ireland's CAP strategy. Being kind to the bees, we have a report. And after 3 years, agricultural shows are back.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, we're all feeling the effects of inflation and it has surged to a 22-year high. Most farms and food producers, though, they notice costs rising as far back as last summer. And in November, research from the representative group Love Irish Food found that small and medium-sized food companies have been hit with input cost rises of almost 30%. But since the tanks rolled into Ukraine, the situation has rapidly worsened. And for small food businesses, the rising costs are proving difficult to weather. And the newspapers are full of it again today. Suzanne Campbell has been chatting to some of those food producers around the country about how they're bearing up. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning, Damien.
So what are you hearing?
What I'm hearing is, I suppose if we go back a little bit, I mean, that Love Irish Foods survey, that was in November. I suppose I started hearing about it going around to food producers really last summer and last autumn. And if we go back, I mean, it seems like so long ago, but Brexit and the pandemic caused huge trade disruption all around the world. So people began to tell me who were packaging and making food on farms like cheeses or jams or whatever, that their timber had gone up. Their paper had gone up, their plastic. And what they were doing was they were kind of going, OK, this is to do with the pandemic and Brexit and shipping and the ship stuck in the Suez Canal. And there were reasons upon reasons about why prices going up, and they just bore it. So what they did was they didn't pass it on to the consumer. They kind of absorbed the cost themselves and went, this will all sort itself out when the pandemic ends. The pandemic did ostensibly end for most of us in terms of that big trade disruption. The hangovers of that are still there, but this new element, this fuel crisis with Russia, the grain crisis, which is coming really more on stream next year, has hit really inputs really, really hard. And farms are really suffering, as all of us are. And we know when we put petrol in our car, we buy home heating oil, it's gone massively up. But for food producers, there's other elements as well really hitting them. I first spoke with Aisling Flanagan of Velvet Cloud, which is a sheep farm just outside Claremorris in Mayo. And they make Velvet Cloud yogurt, cheese and milk on the farm. It's really, really beautiful yogurt. I mean, if you're dairy sensitive or anything, it's perfect for you. But what she put up a video last week, and this is what drew me to her, saying, oh, I saw food business close on Twitter, and everybody was going, oh, could you not keep going? And, you know, could you not try a little harder? And she just said, I don't think people understand what we're going through.
The cost of making food.
The cost of making food has rocketed, and people are really going, we're going to see a lot more closures. So she takes it up here talking about her post.
I saw a husband and wife food business post, it was a very sad post, that they had to close due to rising costs. And I was struck by the responses to that post. You know, a lot of people obviously, you know, being very sympathetic, but there was quite a lot of surprise in the comments on the post. And, you know, oh, that's shocking. Can you not keep going a bit longer? So I felt, you know what, maybe we need to just explain things a bit simpler, how challenging it is for food producers and for farmers who are producing food on their farm. So I put up a post and I just explained in that post, whether you're selling jars of jam or jars of sheep's milk yogurt, how many pots you'd need even to survive on a basic salary. So if you get an electricity increase, for lots of us is anything from 5 to 15 grand this year, how devastating and challenging that can be for small businesses. Now, we're really lucky in Velvet Cloud. We're tapping into a trend that's, you know, accelerating the interest in microbiome, the interest in gut health, the interest in allergies, etc. But if you're in a more mature market or you're a smaller business that doesn't isn't seeing those increases. It's just a really challenging time. And I think we're going to see a lot more sad stories in the months to come.
What other costs are you seeing that are rising that people probably wouldn't see or understand when they buy a product?
Yeah, we're getting increases in the cost of our couriers. So again, we got a knock during COVID. We lost our restaurant business, so we had to go online, which was great for us to be able to sell online. But now our courier is charging us more to deliver. And we're finding that difficult, you know, to put onto the consumer. We're finding all of our other transport costs are increasing. So our distribution costs into the supermarkets are increasing. Our ingredient is just fresh sheep's milk and live cultures, but the milk itself is costing us an awful lot more to produce because our on-farm costs have gone up. Fertilizer is huge. We use primarily clover pastures, but we still have to, you know, get the grass growing early. And then there's so much pressure on grocery shopping and electricity bills. Our staff will need increases in salary costs. So really, it's coming at us from all angles.
What are your options? I mean, is it to put an increase on the price of your end product? What do you do?
From a consumer point of view, we're already an expensive product, premium product, because the costs are high. So it's very difficult to do that. What our plan is and what we've been trying to do is just increase the brand awareness and keep those sales going up. We've a reasonable investment at Bloom this year at the bank holiday weekend.
Right.
We're just trying to get the word out there. So at least if we get more sales, the significance and the damage from all of those cost increase hopefully won't be as great. But it's hard, Suzanne. It's very difficult.
Now, the government has in recent weeks announced a new round of measures, you know, for all of us, which includes a cut in the rate for VAT and electricity to lessen inflation. And there may be more help on offer, but, you know, is it going to be enough is the question. But some farmers and food producers, I mean, many of them, when you talk to them, feel that we're likely to see quite a few businesses just go to the wall. Derek Allen farms a Castlemyne farm outside Roscommon, and he is a really well-known butcher shop and online shop selling products. He raises his own beef, sheep and pigs, turkeys on the farm. And they also went into ready meals. So they have a food unit as well. And it really is really excellent quality stuff. I mean, he's well-known. And for Derek, like, he feels it's a perfect storm, to be honest, because from farm costs to every stage along the process of production for him is rising alarmingly.
The fertilizer was the biggest rise, tripled, I think, in price. And then your feed costs are gone really high as well. Now, we grow our own barley and that, so I was kind of a bit insulated from that, which was great. But the diesel, you know, every time you get into the tractor now, you're conscious of how much diesel you're burning and what it's costing. And everything, like from plastic for the bales, come in the summertime, contractor charges, everything is just going to go up and go up significantly. It's not just small rises. Every second week we get a letter in saying this product has arisen, you know, packaging. You know, we might have a lot of ingredients we use for the cooking. All that sort of stuff has gone up. Our couriers for their internet sales, they're all gone up. Surcharges for diesel. And there just seems to be a constant flow of price rises.
How are you dealing with that, and what's the plan, or do you have one?
We've done a review of the prices and we've rolled some prices where we can in small amounts. But I think the problem with the food industry, and the meat especially, is that the supermarkets are kind of dictating a base price, and that is at below cost in a lot of cases. So you can only be a certain amount above it, you know. But when things like this happen, when the costs go so high, there's people going to go out of business, without a doubt.
Obviously, what you're doing, you're rearing your own animals, you're butchering it yourselves, you're hanging it for a good period of time. It's really tasty, high quality food. But yeah, I suppose what you're afraid of is that if you raise the price, people will go back to supermarket beef. Does that gall you quite a bit? I imagine it must.
The way we do things, we're very labour intensive because everything is done, say, the old way of doing it. You know, we handmade all our own sausage, dry cure all our own bacon and ham. Everything is labour intensive, and including the hanging the meat. So you're hanging beef there for maybe 3 weeks, and that's creating flavour and tenderness and all that, but it's also losing a bit of weight. There is a cost to all that. So we have to get a better price than what you pay for your supermarket beef. Plus, we're not doing huge volumes. Like, a lot of this industry works on high volume and, you know, small margins. We try to put out the highest quality we can. You'd be hoping people will stick by you, you know, and try and pork with you on the cost, you know, if the price increases and things like that.
That's Derek Allen there in Castlemyne Farm in Roscommon. And Suzanne, before you go, a few weeks ago, my namesake, Damien O'Reilly, the lecturer in retail, was here. And he was saying, we can all do our own little bit to help. If we spent an extra euro or fiver, an extra fiver a week in our shop on Irish produce, it goes a long way.
Completely. Like, if you look at yogurts, I mean, 70% of the yogurts on Irish supermarket shelves is not produced in Ireland. If you buy the Irish one, or if you buy a local label, like for every €5 you spend in the local community, it generates €100. Or sorry, for every €5 you spend on a local product, it generates €100 for the local community. So that's jobs for the future, jobs, you know, mm-hmm. and ancillary services and all the rest. So it's definitely worth doing in these tricky times.
Yeah, just spend that extra minute maybe and pick up the yogurt, as you said, that's Irish or locally produced. It helps. Listen, thanks a million for that, Suzanne Campbell. Chat to you soon again. Now, the European Commission is in the process of drawing up a new look common agricultural policy for the EU's 10 million farm families. Each member state has been asked to submit a strategy or plan on how they'll implement the policy, which is set to be rolled out for the next 4 years from next year. The Commission has written back to Irish Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, observing that more ambition needs to be demonstrated by Ireland to protect the environment and biodiversity, and points to the rapid growth of the Irish dairy herd in recent years. Brussels wants clarification on how Ireland is going to meet targets before it'll sign off on the new look CAP strategy. Well, joining me now from Brussels is Maciej Golubiewski, who is the head of cabinet with the EU Agricultural Commissioner Janusz Wojciechowski. Mr. Golubiewski, you're very welcome to Countrywide.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be with you.
Good to talk to you again. So, Maciej, can I begin with the correspondence from CAP? The EU has written to Ireland in response to its strategic plan, outlining some of the concerns I mentioned there. But what are the key issues that need addressing from the point of view of the Commission?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. My commissioner is sending his best regards to all the farmers in Ireland. Hopefully he'll see them himself soon when he visits. He needs to visit Ireland at some point during his term. But when it comes to the, your CAP strategic plan, you can actually read the comments sent by the Commission to Ireland, as well as a response from the Ministry, if you just basically go on the website. So every farmer, if he or she is interested in getting to the details, you know, it's all online, published, we're transparent. But the main issue is, there are two main issues. One is obviously the current geopolitical situation, what's happening in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, the attack of Russia and Ukraine, and then the effects that you've discussed already this morning on the radio on commodity prices, on feed prices, on input prices like fertilizer, etc. This is creating a lot of concern. And here, the main message is that, you know, to all countries, is that in their CAP strategic plans, they should do everything possible to get themselves less dependent on externally sourced inputs, and to further increase their resilience of their agricultural sector. So that, and I think here it nicely segues into some other comments which deal mostly with improving a bit more the environmental and climate ambitions of some of the programs of Ireland and other countries. I think the message goes to all. It's not that Ireland or some of the countries particularly singled out. I mean, every country has its own specificity. And in your case, obviously, you mentioned this dairy herd issue. So here, just, you know, we need to remember that being a bit more ambitious on and kind of environmental and climate ambitions really helps us in the long run. While we have those short-term perturbances, we have those big price shocks, inflation, I think in the long run, getting more resilient by being more sustainable and climate friendly, I think it will also help us in terms of ensuring that there's food security. Because after all, we need to feed the people, and the farmers in Ireland are doing an absolutely great job in trying to combine those high environmental standards and trying to feed their society. So there are two sets of issues, but of course, in terms of details, I don't think we have a lot of time to discuss. But I think a little bit more ideas as to how to create more sinks for CO2 emissions. Trying to see, you have a lot of advantages as Ireland because you have a lot of carbon-rich peat soils. You have a biodiversity. You have a great biodiversity network. You have you really have a lot to work with to improve your efforts on emissions. But you know, it's the conversation. So we'll still have time until the end of the year to ensure that we are on the same page before January 23rd, January next year, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you do point to the rapid growth of the dairy herd, but this is from the same commission that actually lifted quotas and sent us off on our merry way with your best wishes to rapidly increase over the past six or 7 years. So it's policy rather than anything else that's driven this rapid growth.
Well, look, I don't think it was recent. The quotas are the story of the 70s and 80s. I mean, we had the so-called milk lakes, we had the butter mountains. You know, this milk quota story, it doesn't really go back just to our previous commissioner. So basically, in the last 20 years, we wanted to ensure that there's more market orientation in agriculture, and I think we've achieved that. And I think it's great that the Irish dairy farmers have exploited this opportunity and have grown production in response to demand. I mean, it's pretty much a demand-driven type of phenomenon, and nobody's criticizing the fact that you're doing so good because
But it is impacting on the quality of our water, for example, and soil.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's basically a balancing act. You need, you know, on one hand, we need to respond to demand. On the other hand, you have to look at some of the elements, such as exactly excess nutrients that get into the waters. Well, obviously the emissions part, but I think that, first of all, the commission will support the farmers in all those efforts. This is the purpose of the cap. We're not just mandating, we are actually trying to incentivize and try to work with member states to come up with programs that would, through good practice and technology, improve the situation. I mean, you have a lot of techniques you can use. You have the low emission slurry spreading, planting more clover, etc., breeding techniques. You have a lot use to really improve.
But do we need to slow down, maybe cut back on cow numbers or at least plateau?
Nobody in the commission will tell you to go against the market trends. I mean, nobody will. This is not our business to, we are, as I said, we promote the market orientation of agriculture. It needs to, first of all, be competitive. It needs to respond to demand. So we're not going to demand artificial demand closures of farms and things like that. It's just really working through technology, innovation, science, improvements in farming to get to where we want. So, I mean, of course, there's also this. You discussed a little bit the local markets this morning, and this is another thing. I mean, we would like to see more local markets being developed, shorter supply chains, less dependence on external shocks and kind of, extended supply chains around the world. So we want strong producer organizations. So I think, more room for small and medium-sized farmers. That should also help.
Okay. We're watching the events in Ukraine with horror from a humanitarian perspective, as you said. But if we focus on food security, which has been threatened by the wars we've discussed and its impact on grain and fertilizer production and prices, is that going to have an impact on the EU's proposed Farm to Fork project, which, for our listeners that don't know, is an ambitious plan to make food production cleaner and greener, which obviously means using less fertilizer, using less pesticides, and that would have an impact on yield. So is there a kind of a conflict now developing, or is that being artificially invented by the farm organisations to rail against the Farm to Fork project?
Look, I'm not going to get into the politics of it per se. I think it's very obvious that there are short-term needs. And I think in our communication from March, when you read it very closely, communication called Safeguarding Food Security and Reinforcing the Resilience of Food Systems, it's very clear that we need to have actions on the short term, medium and long term. And we cannot avoid the long term. About the short term, we already talked about. I'm not going to go into details. We have DG Competition came up with a very ambitious state aid scheme to deal with costs of fertilizer and inputs. This measure has been availed of by Poland and some other countries. If you have fiscal space, you can definitely use this measure up to 35,000 euros in support for farmers who face high input costs and even, So you can really, and 100,000 for an SME. So you can really, if you have the budget, obviously use this, but we had the crisis reserve mobilized, et cetera. So there's a lot of short-term measures. But then on the long run, we have to understand that if we do not attack the problem of climate change, in the long run, this will still undercut. We cannot mortgage our future by kind of, doing nothing now. I mean, we have to remember that resilience also helps with shocks like Ukraine and the attack on Russia. It's not just about climate. Somehow there's a coincidence that becoming more resilient, becoming more sustainable also means becoming less dependent on those developments. So it's not just the climate, but also those things that happen beyond our borders. And here, I can assure you that there is no contradiction between, and we're not planning on kind of rolling back the kind of, you know, the farm to fork commitments and things like that. I think there has to be obviously a proper attention paid to how to do it. It's all about the means, not about the ends. But, you know, if we do not get a bit more ambitious on lowering artificial fertilizers, on lowering dependence on imported inputs, and work with precision farming, precision technology to also reduce costs. Because if you really want to, you know, by using precision farming, you're also in the long run reducing your costs, because you're being a bit more precise about where to put your fertilizer. So this is all, I think, making sense, and it's not contradictory.
Okay, all right. So the farm to fork will not be impacted. It will continue as planned. We're going to leave it there, but it was great chatting to you. And indeed, we do look forward to the Commissioner's visit whenever that will be. And I'm sure he'll find a lot of farmers with lots of questions, and people, obviously, from an environmental perspective as well, have lots of questions for him. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed. That's Maciej Golubiewski there, who is the head of cabinet at DG Agri.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
The All-Ireland Pollinator Plan has been running since 2015, encouraging the preservation of wild habitats for our 99 species of bees. And more recently, Wind Energy Ireland has developed new guidelines on creating a bee-friendly environment at the country's wind farms. Well, Lorna Siggins got more than she bargained for when she visited the Galway Wind Farm, because there she found out about the work with birds as well as with the bees.
So here from this vantage point beside T24, Turbine 24, we can see the expanse of Galway Bay and the burn in the distance, terminating with the Cliffs of Moher just out there directly in front of us. Then we have various lakes here, the Bolishka, which is the freshwater public water system for South Connemara. Then we have Seacon Loch just here in front of us. And when they were naming these two lakes, I think they ran out of names. They're referred to as Nagal Lucca. Then in the distance we can also see Inishir, Inishman and Inishmore, and back in through Rossaville, and then behind us then we have the mountains of Connemara and the 12.
I'm with John O'Sullivan and Carmel Brennan, environmental advisors with SSE Airtricity, and we're also with Aveen Byrne of Wind Energy Ireland. We've just walked up the Peak Ridge Trail, one of a number of trails at the Galway Wind Park, the state's largest wind farm. It's very windy, keeping 58 turbines very happy. And then Carmel notices something at her foot.
Come around this side here.
Okay, so we're up at, what, 250 metres. And what have we actually here now?
We have, it's a little white-tailed bumblebee, a buff-tailed bumblebee, I think. And she is crawling, looks like a queen. She's crawling in and out of a hole at the base of the hardstand area here, just so in and out of the long vegetation, long grass essentially. This could be her nest. She could be just landing there. There's some louseworth in flowers, so she might be looking for that as well. But yeah, it looks like she's busy. She's trying to get her some pollen together and feed her brood. First brood of the year probably,
because it is quite exposed up here.
It is. Now the wind is coming from the other side, so this is a classic example of, it's an earth bank, and there's some vegetation, there's some bare area, so it's ideal for possibly both bumblebees and solitary bees, that they could nest into it. It's a bit of shelter. These species, the bumblebees, are adapted to, you know, the vegetation that's here. The vegetation is adapted to the bees themselves. They both need each other. They've evolved together. So if they're happy to be here, if they're finding enough food, enough shelter, enough safety, that's everything they need. They're just, they're like us in that respect.
She's flying around there. She's
oblivious. Just in this area here, there is a good bit, there's a little bit of flowering.
A little bit of heather.
Yeah, there's a little bit of heather. That's louseworth, that pink one there that's in flower, so that's quite early.
Right.
And as I say, there's a bit of tormental, and that's starting to come out. There's some Narthecium there as well, but that's not quite coming out yet. There seems to be enough for her, basically.
Right, and there'll be more. There'll be a bit more than
I mean, look here as well. Thistles, dandelions all around the edge as well. They are the early flowers, especially the dandelions, clover, that kind of thing.
Right. So how big would that little colony be then?
Even about 200?
Yeah, I think they tend to be like around 40 to 400, but, you know, maybe 1 or 200 might be more common. And when you see, like, this early in the season, when you see these queens out, it's because they're just getting the colony started. So they're putting in all the work right now. They're having to get their first brood ready of workers. And that's another reason why it's so important this time of year to try get as much flowers and food available for these bees as possible, because if they fly too far and they can't get a food source on the way, they can get exhausted. And it's quite a common sight, particularly in the summer, to see a grounded bee and they're just exhausted, they can't find food and they can't get back to the nest. Aww. And this is why it's so important to make these connected patches of habitat. If that queen dies, then that's the whole colony gone.
Okay.
You know.
Right. So we were very lucky now to find her here.
Yeah.
Well, here we're in conifer plantation, really, so the majority of it is under conifers, but we have these wide strips here adjacent to the track. We have fire breaks and just margins of land that still hold the original heather and bog habitat that was originally here. And what we're trying to do with the pollinator plan is just look after them, leave them be. Don't drain them, don't fertilise them, don't reseed them. You know, if they're working fine by themselves, just let them be. And that is probably one of the key messages.
You have a robin listening to you there. So we're a bit early, are we, for some of the flowers that you'd have up here?
The heather is probably the big thing here, and that will start kind of coming out May, June into July, and you'll see it flower, you know, abundantly maybe towards the end of the summer. So, you know, when we were drawing pictures as kids, we used to draw the hills as purple, and that purple represented the heather that was blooming at that time.
So, John, you had to open up some corridors for particular birds.
Yeah, in consultation with National Parks and Wildlife Service, let's just say we're aware that the Greenland white-fronted geese were wintering here. We also had Hooper swans, and their typical trajectory would be of travel would be between lakes. So for that reason, we removed turbines that were between the lakes to allow them free passage during, say, foggy periods where visibility may be poor.
And then you'd have red grouse, woodcock, skylark, snipe, meadow pipits, white-tailed seagull. Have you seen a white-tailed seagull up here?
We have indeed. The white-tailed seagull arrived just as we were trying to get planning permission. Fortunately, the white-tailed seagull has lived here peacefully, has had some chicks, and we'd see them around the wind park occasionally. These birds are absolutely magnificent. They will traverse the country in a day.
Right. So you've seen the white-tailed seagull yourself, have you?
We have indeed, yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the chicks would be quite timid and would often sit at the side of the road as you'd pass by with the jeep. We've also seen snowy owl here on site. So quite a variety, over 45 different species would basically be on or around the site.
Right. And there is a perception that wind turbines are harmful to bird life.
Yeah, birds are very intelligent creatures. There are occasional problems with birds, certain species in particular. We have an ongoing bird monitoring program here, and we do inspections around the turbines to check for any collisions with turbines. And to date, thank God, we haven't had any. The only fatality we've found here on site has been a bat in the early days. We don't have hen harrier in the area. That's one of the, I suppose, species that has suffered on in certain parts of the country, but let's say we have we've been very fortunate here.
Lorna Siggins reporting there from Galway. More information at pollinator.ie. Irish Rural Link is a network of 600 local groups dedicated to the sustainable development of rural Ireland, and the organisation is counting down to a landmark conference in Athlone next Friday where it celebrates its 30th anniversary. Seamus Boland is CEO and he joins me this morning now from the RT studio in Athlone. Seamus, good morning.
Good morning, Damien.
So for our listeners, will you explain what you do at Irish Rural Link? Who do you represent?
Well, I think we represent the ordinary Irish communities, rural communities, people who have set up development associations, people who want to grow their own community, to bring jobs to their own community, to bring social activities, and of course, all sorts of services that they normally should expect, and to grow all of the reasons why people should live comfortably in the rural areas. Yeah. I think our basic motto is sustainable rural communities.
And I've often heard you saying that you represent the brothers and sisters of farmers.
Yes. I remember I was in trouble with my farming colleagues, and remember farming is the main industry in rural Ireland, and they were trying to figure out what was it that we stood for. And he said, finally, I know what you mean. We represent the farmers, you represent the brothers and sisters. So I thought that's not a bad definition as well.
But you do a bit of it yourself, don't you?
I do a bit of farming, yes. I've on 80 acres, it's where I was born. We still do a bit of beef and sheep, not as much as we used to. Did pigs and dairying once upon a time, all of that. But love the farming.
Yeah. Now, while you may argue that farmers, you know, getting all the cap money, that it should be maybe spread out a little bit more beyond the farm gate. And I think listening to you at different conferences over the years, that would have been an argument that you would have made. Do you still think that, Seamus?
We've always made the argument that the Rural Development Programme should have covered a wider range. I remember a young lady in Galway at a conference, a European conference, and she asked an interesting question. She was a hairdresser in a very rural area, and she said, I'm a hairdresser, I have my own business, I have lots of costs living in rural Ireland, etc., but I don't get anything. And it was an interesting comparison in terms of assistance. But look, it's not that we want to take away from the farmers, we never ever said that, but we simply said that the budget for growing the rural communities and to create a situation where people can stay and live as a matter of choice in their own areas should be developed. And when you think of the problems affecting small towns and villages over the years, I think our criticism back in the 90s has been borne out, because we haven't fully guarded those areas and make sure the investment has gone in.
Yeah, but you see, at the same time, though, that cap money, we were only talking about cap earlier on, as you will have heard there, that money is spent locally, so that the hairdresser mightn't be in business if the farmer and the farmer's family weren't receiving cap to stay on the land and be able to spend that money locally.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we would have never disputed that. The cap money not alone kept farmers in the businesses on the farms. And remember, we have a larger smallholder network than we've ever had in any other country in Europe. So that cap money was absolutely essential. And yes, it did that. But I suppose what you have to try and develop is a situation where people in the wider stream of occupations can actually live there as well. And unfortunately, we've seen the results of that. Towns and villages have suffered a great deal. Back in the 90s, we're suffering in the zeros as well. Yeah. So that's slightly changing now at the moment.
And when you say suffering, like, go back to 1990 or 91 or 2 when you started. Think of any local town or village in rural Ireland then. It was thriving. There was, you know, there was the ubiquitous number of pubs, maybe a bank, post office, small family news agent, and so on. A lot of those towns have been bypassed, and you go through them now, Seamus, and they're like ghost towns.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that is the reality, that unfortunately, a number of things, I suppose. It's worth noting that in a sense, the car contributed to some of this, because these large, massive supermarkets began to mushroom all over the place. So people began to drive, and sometimes drive out of their own village, because I suppose the supermarket gave a cheaper product, etc. But in doing that, they neglected. I remember writing an article once upon a time on post offices closing, and I got myself into some trouble by saying, well, it would help if we all used the post offices. And I think what we found in the pandemic, when we started to use our local shops, use our local services, there was an amazing change in how they developed. And in some sense, Minister Humphrey's announcements over the year of hubs and businesses begins to bring us back to that place, which is, I think, a good place to start.
But is all of that, and the closing down of post offices, banks, small shops, as you said, isn't that just part of evolution, the evolution of life, that no matter how much we lament it and we'd love to have those idyllic little villages with everybody living there and with a selection of shops, it's not the way we live anymore, and there's nothing we were ever going to be able to do to stop it, and it's something that's happening not only in Ireland but across the world.
I think so. Look, you can say that. As I said, it's very much part of the car culture that started, and we began to, you know, we began to use two systems. We had these large systems of food distribution, and we stopped doing the local food distribution. You know, one of the great strengths in rural Ireland over the few years, Damien, I think you've covered it yourself, is the farmer markets and the small cooperatives. Okay, these could be, I think, the answer. And if we're talking about a changing society, which we are in terms of climate change, in terms of the current massive crisis that we're in at the moment, I think we need to start looking back at shortening those food chains considerably. But that takes a lot more effort and policy than we have right now. And I think that's the way forward. So it's not a natural thing to think that this will continue forever. I don't think it will.
Seamus, I'm sure you've been following the whole turf debate closely, not least because you're an Offaly man. And a picture has been painted of rural Ireland, you know, being attacked and people going to go cold in their homes. In the context of decarbonising from smoky fuels, what is your take of what you've seen in the last few weeks?
Yes, Irish Rural Link have been really involved in this, as you might know, Damien. And it's, to me, it's a straightforward reality of fuel poverty. That's what it was back when the directive to conserve bogs was introduced nearly 10, 12 years ago, and it hasn't changed. The reality is we have the guts of 100,000 households in that kind of income bracket, middle income to lower, really dependent on the old Stanley 8 or the old stove. And that's the system they have. And to change that system costs money. Of course, turf is cheaper than any other fuel. So there has never been a great, encouragement to change that system. Yeah. But I think we have to change it now. It is fuel poverty. And the reason why people are angry was that they still haven't managed to change their fuel systems. And until they do, they remain angry.
Okay, well, Seamus, congratulations on the 30 years. You've really led that organisation very well in that time. And your conference is on in Athlone next Friday.
Yes, it's moderated by Kieran Mullooly formerly from this parish. And we have a great selection of panellists. Our chairperson, Tara Farrell, will be very much present. And we have people like Pat McDonough of great. Supermax speaking, Conor Skehan, Dr. Maura Farrell, Mark Foley of AirGrid, and I'm Fintan O'Brien of the Department of Agriculture, and many more. So it'll be a gathering of everybody, old and new, and I hope in the Sheraton Hotel people can tune in or even come up and see us.
Okay, and more information on irishrurallink.ie. Congratulations, Seamus. Thanks for joining us from our Athlone studio there this morning. Well, you're talking about rural Ireland and traditions, and of course, the agricultural show has been hit by COVID over the past 3 years, but they are back. And in fact, I believe Fiona Duggan and Fionnuala Taylor, for both of ye, it's this weekend. I'm going to go to Fionnuala Taylor first in Thomastown in County Kilkenny, because you're up and running.
Good morning, Damien. Yes, we're up and running here in the rain in the beautiful valley by the River Nore with Grenan Castle in the background. Fantastic views, big turnout. It's the first show back after 3 years, so we're absolutely delighted to be here.
All right, and the gates have been open there since 8 o'clock. So what are some of the highlights for you this year, Fionnuala, now that you're back?
The big highlight is actually we have the biggest entries we've ever had in the history of this show. It's been going on since the 1940s. My dad was one of the beginning of the stewards in it. And it's just brilliant to have such a big entry here today. We have in-hand classes, which are all the young stock, mares and foals. We have working hunter, and we have ridden classes. So it's all systems go.
Yeah, I'd say there's great excitement because, not least, it's an opportunity for people that love the shows to get back, having not been able to do so for the last couple of years. And Fiona Duggan, New Market on Fergus Agricultural Show is happening tomorrow, I believe, at Dromoland Castle. What a lovely backdrop you have as well.
Indeed, indeed it is. It's kicking off at 9 o'clock in the morning. Again, we have here today, it's a damp morning, so hopefully tomorrow the weather-wise should be good. And yes, you have the view of the backdrop. We have Dromoland Castle. We're on the grounds of the Dromoland Estate and the lands of Lord and Lady Inchy Quinn, who we most sincerely thank for allowing us to have our show here. Yeah. We also have the turret in as well. You have the view of the turret, which is across the road from Dromoland Castle. And we have in total then, we have roughly 90 classes on the day between cattle showing, show jumping, horse showing, working hunter and pony showing, and then our ever popular dog show.
And I think every dog in the area gets entered for that.
Most definitely, most definitely. We do have a particular special class. It is sponsored by the Green family of Newmarket, whose father, Jackie, and mother, Mary, would have been running the dog show, I would say, for years when we were kids.
Yeah.
And it's the Cora Cotlin canine class, and it's specifically for dogs with an address of Newmarket and Fergus.
They have to have the address. There might be more of them. Everybody seems to have got a dog.
And, yes,
a podcast in the last 2 years. Fiona, back to yourself. You say it's raining there. Does that make a huge difference?
Well, I think one of the nice things about Ireland is everybody has in their wardrobe water gear, so we're all systems go. It makes no difference at all to us. We have a great team of committee. We have wonderful sponsors. And just a quick shout out to Transformate and Tierney O'Neill, who without them we wouldn't be able to go ahead, because we spend our time looking for sponsors around the country. Mm. It's free to get in here. A great family day out if anyone wants to come down, have a look at the horses and enjoy the day. Yeah. Bring the brolly. They won't mind.
And Fiona, it is vital that you get sponsorship, because these shows are quite costly, I'm sure.
Very much so. I mean, even during COVID, we still had expenses for the 2 years that we were in lockdown. We still had expenses. We still had to maintain insurance. We still had to pay for the grounds. We had a lot of outgoings during COVID, even though we'd no income. And as Fionnuala said, their sponsorship is a vital part of our shows. Yeah. Without the sponsorship, most shows in the country would not be able to run. And we sincerely thank them for their sponsorship.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Fiona Duggan in Newmarket on Fergus and Fionnuala Taylor in Thomastown and County Kilkenny. It's great to hear you both sounding excited. And we were just chatting about great Irish traditions. And one of them, obviously, is the local agricultural show. And we wish you well this weekend. And the website for more details on the shows that will be going on all over the country between now and next September, irishshows.org. That's all we have time for this week. Liam Mullen was on sound. Taran O'Sullivan was our broadcast coordinator. And Eileen Heron produced. After the 9 o'clock news, it's time for playback. And we hope you enjoy the rest of your bank holiday weekend. But when the clock strikes midnight tonight, Saturday, of course, turns to Sunday, and April will turn to May, and RTÉ Radio 1 and RTÉ Lyric FM will begin celebrations of the Dawn Chorus. From midnight until 4 a.m, there'll be a mix of music and documentaries about birds. And from 4 until 7, Derek Mooney and the team and guests will bring us the sound of live bird song from the Birdwatch Ireland, Kerskinny Marsh Nature Reserve in County Cork. So we're going to leave you now with the real stars, the birds whose song is the hopeful sound of a new day and a new month dawning. We're not here next week. We'll chat to you in a fortnight.
Countrywide on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Pick up this week's paper to find out what the future of your farm payments will look like.